And good afternoon to everyone here and in Canton, and maybe at home, depending on where you're tuning in from. It's wonderful to be able to have everybody here in our previous congregation in Phoenix. We would often have just so many people, whether they were homebound individuals or whatnot. But this technology right here is a marvelous thing for when you're at home and can't get in. Now, in Phoenix, Arizona, we didn't have to worry so much about getting snowed in and missing services. But I hear maybe some things like that happen here. It's a little bit not as warm. But anyway, it's just a little bit not as warm. So watching people's Facebook posts showing up as it's 104 degrees in Arizona still. And I'm like, well, all my windows are open and it feels great. So other than Hurricane Harvey, there was another thing that was kind of like popping up in the news right up until Wednesday. After Wednesday, it kind of just dropped off. But how many of you know how big the Powerball was? It's pretty high. This was the second highest Powerball. Actually, I think the highest one was back in 2016. They had something like $1.6 billion on it. They were estimated this one was going to actually be higher than that. But it only got up to $770 million. That's it. But this one actually offered the single biggest payout ever because only one person held the ticket. And so she ended up, after taxes, a paltry $336 million. Now, the probability of winning the Powerball is only 1 in 292 million. Now, the population of the United States is somewhere around 340, 350 million people. So, you know, it's like just pick anybody in the country of America, and that's about your odds of winning the Powerball. What do you think your odds are? This is you've got the Great Lakes, so it's not fully landlocked. But what do you think the odds are of being attacked by a shark? We can do audience participation here. It's okay. What do you think the odds are? 1 in 10,000. Actually, 1 in 8 million. 1 in 8 million. 1 in 8 million for getting attacked by a shark. What about being struck and killed by a meteor? You got the Perseid meteor shower. It's a beautiful thing to see in the sky. Meteor. 1 in 10 million. Any other takers? 1 out of 25 million. 1 in 1.6 million. So you have better odds of being struck by a meteor than winning the Powerball. What about being struck by lightning? You're probably sitting there going, I read this somewhere for science class, right? 1 in 135,000. So between Bloomington and Normal, you got about that, right? 75, 50. So your odds of getting struck by lightning are about, you know, pick one out of Bloomington Normal. So this is in a lifetime, you know, 1 in 135,000. If you haven't noticed, the odds are getting, these are all tragic things, so not in our favor, but they are going down. What about dying in a car accident? 1 in 25. 1 in 25. Not that bad, but they are dropping. 1 in 47,718 for death in a car accident. So why are we talking about odds and probabilities? There was actually a reporter that was going out in and around Wednesday, leading up to Wednesday for the Powerball, and they were offering people to buy their Powerball ticket that they just purchased. From what I understand, you can have different values. I don't know. I have never actually bought a Powerball ticket, but there are different levels you can buy, and she was offering them twice what they had just spent on their ticket. And out of 14 people, 11 people said, nope, I'm feeling it, I'm going to keep this ticket. But she was offering them twice the price. But they felt that their odds were better to keep it. They wanted to be able to take that risk. Now, when you and I go about doing things during the day at life, we make decisions. If somebody's going to offer you twice what you just paid for an asset or an investment, would you take it? Depends, right? Maybe yes. Maybe if the flip on it is far higher, you say, no, no, I would not take that. I foresee far better return on this investment down the road. I am not going to take your offer. But there are so many decisions that we make. And whether we want to run the numbers or say that we're running numbers, probability and odds play a huge role in what we do, why we do it, why we make the decisions that we make. Because we're sitting there going like, well, if I don't get out of bed now, well, then I'm going to be late. I know I have to get out of bed at this specific time in order to be able to get dressed, have my prayer time, get through everything I need to in the morning, make sure the kids are dressed, make sure I'm out, and I'm not going to hit traffic. And so we'll play that when we look at the snooze button, right? Does anybody else play those numbers in their head when you're looking at the clock? I do that. I'm like, oh, too early, snooze. I can last for another 8 minutes. I can go faster or whatever the case is. But we look at those odds and we look at those probabilities every day. The average person makes about 35,000 decisions a day. Did you realize that? Black belt, brown belt, am I going to have my belt match my shoes? Am I going to bring a jacket with me today? Am I going to take this route to work? 35,000 decisions a day. They say that kids make fewer, so 11,000 to 18,000 for kids. But if you were to go ahead and extrapolate that over the entirety of your life, we're talking probabilities, making decisions, whatever you're going to do. If the average individual lives to be about 75 years, you're going to have 750 million decisions over the course of your life. 750 million decisions. Now, that doesn't actually count all of the options from which we're choosing, right? Because you have various options. Sleep in, get up now, totally ignore everything, you know, go right, go left, go straight. We're just saying the decisions that are made are about 35,000, not the various options, because there are countless more options that are given to us. But if you were presented with the opportunity to consider, well, you have 35,000 decisions to make today, what are you going to do with those? And if somebody says, well, you're going to have 750 million decisions in the course of your life, what are you going to do with those? Who can really wrap their mind around 750 million? This lady that just won the lottery, it was like $778 million. But, I mean, after all the taxes and the winnings and other stuff goes out, that's a lot of decisions. I start to glaze over when I think about that many. Because I'm like, well, all of a sudden, the importance or the power of any one decision seems a little bit smaller. Because, well, I have $750 million to burn. What's a dollar? What's $5? I'm going to go get an $8 coffee today because I've got money to burn. Well, I've got 750 million decisions over the course of my life. I've got a few to burn. Eh, so what if that decision wasn't as well thought out? Or so what if I opted to do this instead? So today we're going to talk about the power of a decision. What is the power of our decisions? When we go through life, there are things called snap decisions. You know, you have a knee-jerk reaction to something. There are also well-thought-out and well-deliberated decisions that we make. But when you're presented with so many things over the course of the day, there have been studies that show that you will have your most effective decision-making towards the beginning of the day because you have not committed your mental acuity and your intellect to so many other things to kind of like reduce the efficacy or reduce the power of your decision making. So a few years ago, they actually had a study with former President Obama with his wardrobe. It was always a gray suit. It was always a white shirt. It was always these other things. So he didn't have to make a decision. What is he going to wear today? Gray suit. What is he going to wear today? It was one less decision that he had to make, because if you're asking for a president to make a very profound decision on something, you don't want him to have wasted it on what colored suit he was going to wear that day. You want him to have as much mental acuity as he can to make the decisions that he needs to run the country. But that power of a decision can sometimes get lost. So if you have 750 million decisions in your life to make, and every decision is worth a penny, right? Penny for your thoughts. What are you going to do? What option? How much are you going to have at the end of life? Got fast math people here? Mr. Hummel's got it. $7.5 million. Who would like $7.5 million? One, he wants twice. He's going to double down. You're going to take it for you and your dad, right, Drew? But all of a sudden, when you say 750 million decisions, and you say, I'm going to give you a penny for each decision, you're like, that's a penny. Whatever. I'm not going to pick that penny up. But you're like, would you like $7.5 million? All of a sudden, when it's all lumped together, the power of the accumulated decision becomes much more vast. It becomes much more noticeable. It's not just a drop in the bucket. So when we start talking about the power of a decision, we want to make sure that we're looking at the entire picture. If you ever have free time, you go to the mall, or you go to a park, or you have to go to the DMV to renew your license, you can do a wonderful thing. You can watch decisions in action. You can watch other people, right? You can sit back, you can see, okay, oh, little kid there, maybe his finger's creeping up towards his nose. No, 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 don't do it. Your mom's watching. Everybody going, oh, no, don't wipe it on your shirt. But you watch decisions happening, how somebody is going to react to things. You can watch people when you're at a restaurant. You can see how they're interacting. You can kind of start to get an idea for how their relationship is, what it's built on. When we look at these decisions happening, we start to get a picture. As parents, we'll often do, or other adults that are watching kids, the guardians, the caretakers, you watch the kid, right? You watch them. Are they going towards the door? Is the door open? Is the door closed? How close are they to the top of the stairs? Are they going to reach in? Is the sibling going to run over the other child and just bowl them over? Are they going to take that wonderfully stainable berry and just wipe it all over themselves? You're watching these decisions, and you're trying to guide and direct the child to be able to make the best decision for their overall investment of that 750 million decisions that we get to make. You have couples, and we do this through marriage counseling as well, but you have couples, sometimes a part of that, one of the assignments that you can get from the pastor is to go and watch other couples, talk to other couples, and you can see how they're interacting, how they communicate with one another, how they fail to communicate with one another, how they're working with one another, and you watch, and you can learn. Again, I said at a restaurant, you might be able to watch and see how somebody is communicating with his spouse or vice versa, and you can see and get an idea of what kind of a relationship is there. Well, newsflash here, God also watches us. We're talking about decisions. We're talking about being able to see in other people a bit of that relationship, a bit of the interaction that they might have. Well, God also watches us. Why do you think he watches us? Well, why would a parent watch their kid? Make sure they're safe. Make sure they don't run into the street by themselves. Make sure that the decision that is in front of them, they have all of the information with which to make the best possible decision so they don't have regret over the decision that they made. God watches us. He wants to look in us. Just like when you see a kid and you're watching them play at a park, you can tell who the daredevils are at the park, right? Man, they will just jump. They'll climb up. They'll swing the highest and they'll jump off of the swing. Well, those patterns that we see in people as they interact and as they go about making their decisions are also present in each and every one of us as we are making our decisions, our 750 million decisions that we have over the course of a life. We can start to see a trend. We can start to see how and why, what our motivations are. And that is, in essence, what God is doing. So we're, again, talking about the power of a decision. Let's turn over to Jeremiah chapter 1. God not only wants to watch us to see what we're doing, to keep us safe, but God wants to get to know us. We can watch people, we can watch our kids, we can watch friends, couples, all those other individuals that we were talking about. But God wants to also watch us. We do that, it helps us to get a better idea of who somebody is. And it's the same thing with God and us. Jeremiah chapter 1, verse 5. Jeremiah chapter 1 and verse 5. Speaking of the calling of Jeremiah as a prophet, it says, "The word of the Lord came to me, saying," verse 4, "Before I formed you in the womb, I knew you. Before you were born, I sanctified you. I ordained you a prophet to the nations." God had a relationship with Jeremiah before he was born. He started building something there. When God wants to get to know each and every one of us, he starts building something, just as he did here with Jeremiah, just as he did here. He wants us to take that and run with it. Now, Jeremiah says in verse 6, he says, "Ah, Lord God, behold, I cannot speak, for I'm a youth." And so there's this interaction going back and forth. Jeremiah says, he decides that I'm too young to do this. And God says, no, you can do this. And he works with them. And we can see throughout the rest of Jeremiah's life, all the things that God did through him as a prophet. But God was helping him in that decision making. God was helping and guiding him, but God was also very much watching what he was going to do. Let's go to Genesis chapter 22. Genesis 22. This is a wonderful story here of the patriarch Abraham. God is working with him. Has been for some time up to this point. I think it was Abraham was called when he was, I think it was 75. And God began working with him, bringing him along. And there were opportunities where Abram did a great job. There were opportunities where he didn't, where he listened to God and had faith in God, and there are other opportunities where he didn't. God told him to move and go, and he went. He's in Egypt. He's in Assyria. He didn't have the faith to commit fully to God, and he says, okay, I have to do something to protect myself, so I'm going to tell a half-truth. I'm going to tell a lie and say that my wife is my sister. Well, God's watching all the decisions that Abraham has been making over his life. And here in Genesis 22 and verse 12, Genesis chapter 22, verse 12, this is after he has had Abraham take his son Isaac, the son of promise, up onto the mountain for a sacrifice. And Abraham is about to sacrifice his son. And the angel of the Lord, verse 11, called to Abraham from heaven and said, "Abraham, Abraham." And so he says, "Here I am." And God says to him, "Do not lay your hand on the lad or do anything to him, for now I know that you fear God, since you have not withheld your son, your only son, from me." At this point in Abraham's life, he's a very old man. Solidly into his 110s-ish years. You know, there's no specific as to exactly how old he was at this time based on the age of Isaac. It said he was a young lad. But the young lad was also carrying the bundle of sticks up the hill or up the mountain. So he was old enough to help out and to do things. But Abraham was old. He'd been following God for decades, going all over, sojourning as God told him, being patient sometimes and not at others. But God says to him now I know. After 35 years, 40 years of decision making, I have seen the arc of your decisions. I have seen what the trajectory of your decisions are, and I know. I know what you're going to do. As parents, sometimes we can say this about our kids. Oh, I saw that coming a mile away. Why did I not stop it? Right? I knew they were going to do that. I could just tell. And sometimes we say that in frustration. I think most of the time we would say that in frustration. But wouldn't it be great here for us as parents to look and to see, oh, now I know. I knew you were going to do that, and I was just so overjoyed. My heart was swelling. I knew you were going to do the right thing because you have shown a pattern of obedience. You have shown a pattern of following God and making the right decision. You are taking those 750 million decisions that you have, and you're showing me, as your parent, what you're going to do and how you're going to act. We're in that same boat. Abraham was in that boat with God. God wanted to know who he was, what he was made of, where his heart was actually where his heart actually lied and who he was committed to. Was he going to be committed to himself and his own preservation like he was when he lied about his wife? Or was he willing to make that sacrifice and just say, nope, I trust my Father, I trust him, that he's going to take care of it. And at this point in his life, God said, I know. Your decisions have shown what you're going to do, and now I know. Let's go to 1 Peter chapter 1. We'll pick it up in verse 20. 1 Peter chapter 1. Verse 20. God's desire for us with decision making and seeing our decisions, as I said, is to get to know us. He believes so much. He is so committed to getting to know us, that as we read here in 1 Peter chapter 1 and verse 20, it says, for he indeed, speaking of Christ, was foreordained before the foundation of the world, foreordained to die, but was manifest in these last times for you, who through him believe in God, who raised him from the dead and gave him glory, so that your faith and hope are in God. He invested in that, just in us, each and every one of us, before the foundation of the world. He says, I want to get to know them. And because I want to get to know them, there are some things that I'm going to have to do. With the patriarchs, he was there. He walked with them. He talked with them. And he opened up the opportunity for us to be able to have his spirit in us, to have that same relationship where he gets to know us, gets to guide us along and see whether or not we're going to follow our dad or not. Are we going to be committed to him? And our elder brother was just as committed to this same goal of getting to know us that he... It's not like he went along going like, oh, okay, Dad. Okay, this seems like a good enough plan, but I'm not sure. Christ was just as committed to this. As the word there before the foundation of the world, he and the Father committed to doing this, to getting to know us, to getting to have that relationship with us, so they know where our heart and where our allegiance lies. Matthew chapter 7. Matthew chapter 7, verse 7. At least we'll start in verse 7. Matthew chapter 7, verse 7. It says, ask, and it will be given to you. Seek, and you will find. Knock, and it will be opened to you. For everyone who asks receives, and he who seeks finds, and to him who knocks it will be opened. Or what man is there among you who, if his son asks for bread, will give him a stone? Or if he asks for a fish, will he give him a serpent? If you then, being evil, know how to give good gifts to your children, how much more will your Father who is in heaven give good things to those who ask him? Therefore, whatever you want men to do to you, do also to them, for this is the law and the prophets. He's talking about our conduct. Those decisions that we have throughout the day, the 35,000 that we have each day, are we reflecting him? Are we reflecting the kind of child that he wants to be able to invite in his kingdom? He wants to get to know us and see whether or not we're going to persevere. Are we going to ask and keep asking? Are we going to knock and keep knocking? Are we going to depend on our dad? Or are we going to question, well, I just don't think he's really been caring for me. I feel a little bit separated. I don't think he loves me anymore. Are we going to come up with these other excuses as to why we can do what we want to do? Verse 13, enter by the narrow gate, for wide is the gate and broad is the way that leads to destruction. And there are many who go in by it, because narrow is the gate and difficult is the way which leads to life. And there are few who find it. We are not promised to have an easy walk with God. The decisions that are in front of us are not easy decisions all the time. Sometimes they're of a higher magnitude and more difficulty than others. But when we look at what they all add up to, the gravity and the importance of each decision that we have is immense. If you ever get into stats, I love stats. I love numbers. When you look at the graphs of information and you start to see a plot, he's like, oh, made a decision here. And you see all these dots all over. You're like, okay, well, what does that mean? And then you can plot a line through that or an arc that goes through that that says, this is the trend line of all of these data points. Maybe you have an outlier that's way up and is a weird, you're like, how did that even get up there? Or maybe there's something way in a different quadrant where it's not there. But when you look at the arc of the entire thing, which way is it going? our decisions are those little data points that we're dropping all over in our relationship with God. And he wants to know, do I actually see it, a trend line here? Is it arcing upwards? Is it going down? Is it just flatline? And I don't know if they have a pulse. Are they lukewarm? What is going on with this person? Well, where are we dropping our data points? Where are we putting those decisions to let God get to know us? Are we letting him get to know us? Or are we just saying, well, maybe, maybe not, ho-hum. What are we doing? Verse 15. Beware of false prophets who come to you in sheep's clothing, but inwardly are ravenous wolves. You will know them by their fruits. Do men gather grapes from thorn bushes or figs from thistles? Even so, every good tree bears good fruit, but a bad tree bears bad fruit. A good tree cannot bear bad fruit, nor can a bad tree bear good fruit. Every tree that does not bear good fruit is cut down and thrown into the fire. Therefore, by their fruits you will know them. Now, while this is specifically talking about wolves in sheep's clothing coming in, those false prophets, leaders, this same comparison can be said for each and every one of us. You can get to know somebody by watching what they do. You watch them over time. You get a longitudinal study of watching somebody, seeing their decisions every week at Sabbath services, whenever you have them at camp. However often you see somebody, you can start to see the arc. And you get a better, more well-rounded idea of who they are. It takes time. If we go back to the story of Abraham, it didn't happen like day two. God's like, oh, you're the guy. I knew it the second I met you. No question about it. No, this is God working with somebody that became the father of the faithful. And it took time. Decades. Decades for him to say that now he knew. I know you well enough to know what you're going to do. So God wants to look at our decisions, and he wants to get to know us. He wants to get to know us. Another thing, when we're talking about the power of our decisions, if we take the time, we can also get to know God. It's not a one-way road. It's bidirectional. God also, through our decisions, wants us to get to know him. Let's go to Genesis 18. Genesis chapter 18. Because each of our decisions has an outcome. Depending on which way our decision is leaning, you can have a positive outcome, you can have a negative outcome. But after we make a decision, like in business, they have best practices. We did this project, the project has concluded. Let's go back and let's see what worked and what didn't. So they'll go through and they'll say best practices. This is what we're going to keep. This is our benchmark that we're measuring it against. And so here, we're going to know what to do better the next time. So, and they reassess how they're moving forwards. Well, when we make decisions, we're kind of in that, we have the opportunity to be in that same boat. Where we go, we make a decision, we see what the outcome is, and then we see how that affects, how it should affect our future decisions. And here in Genesis chapter 18, verse 11, I think it's supposed to be Exodus 18. Yes, Exodus 18. Apologize for that. Exodus 18, verse 11. So the children of Israel had been sojourning out of the land of Egypt, out of captivity. They're going through. So many things have occurred up to this point. They've had manna. They've had the bitter water made sweet. They got water from the rock, not to mention all the plagues and all the miracles that it took to get them out of the land of Egypt. All these things that God was doing, investing in these people. Investing in them before they'd actually even made the decision to follow him. So this is before they're there saying, all that you say we will do. This is before that. And Jethro, Moses' father-in-law, comes up and he's giving some advice to Moses. But here in chapter 18 of Exodus, verse 11, actually let's pick it up in verse 9. Verse 8. We're going to move back a couple verses. And Moses told his father-in-law all that the Lord had done to Pharaoh and to the Egyptians for Israel's sake, all the hardship that had come upon them on the way and how the Lord had delivered them. Then Jethro rejoiced for all the good which the Lord had done for Israel, whom he had delivered out of the hand of the Egyptians. And Jethro said, Blessed be the Lord, who has delivered you out of the hand of the Egyptians, and out of the hand of Pharaoh, and who has delivered the people from under the hand of the Egyptians. Now I know that the Lord is greater than all the gods, for in the very thing in which they have behaved proudly, he was above them. So this is an individual that was not there with Israel going through. Moses had to recount all of this to him and to share the story. And what is his response? Sounds a whole lot like Genesis when God was talking about Abraham. He's like, now I know. You tell me all of these things? He's God. Not only is he a great God, but he's actually better than all the other gods. He says, when you think about where those other gods that he bested had their power, he beat them at their own game. He beat them where they were supposed to be the most powerful. Where they behaved proudly, he was above them. And he goes on to offer, in verse 12, burnt offerings and other sacrifices to God. So through the decisions that God makes, through those decisions and the ways that he works with us, we have the opportunity to also, like Jethro, say, now I know. I see what you're doing with me. I see how you're guiding me out of the land of Egypt. I see how you're preserving me. I see how you're caring for me and providing whatever I need, even though I feel like I'm in the midst of a desert where there's nothing. He did all of those things for ancient Israel, because he wanted them to get the idea, to get the picture that they could count on him, just as he got to the point with their patriarch 400 some odd years earlier that he knew what Abraham was going to do. He wanted the children of Israel to know what he was going to do. Whenever you come into adversity, I'm going to take care of you. We're going to drive them out with bees. We're going to extend the day. We're going to split the water. We're going to whatever it takes, I'm going to take care of you. Just like we as parents want to be able to do that for our kids, God was wanting the children there to know and to grasp the magnitude of how much he loves them and what he wanted to do for them. Let's go to 2 Kings verse 5. There's a story of another individual, not of the house of Israel. We'll start in verse 1, 2 Kings chapter 5, verse 1. Now Naaman, commander of the army of the king of Syria, not usually a friend of Israel, I would say. He was a great and honorable man in the eyes of his master because by him the Lord had given victory to Syria. So God had actually used Naaman to give victory to Syria, but he was also a mighty man of valor, but a leper. And the Syrians had gone out on raids and had brought back captive a young girl from the land of Israel, and she waited on Naaman's wife. And she said to her mistress, If only my master were with the prophet who is in Samaria, for he would heal him of his leprosy. Naaman went in and told his master, saying, Thus and thus says the girl who is from the land of Israel. So Naaman's like, he overhears this young girl is working for his wife, and he hears what she says, and he goes to his boss. And the king of Syria says, Go now, and I will send a letter to the king of Israel. So he's like, Go, take care of this. Go and see the prophet. So he departed and took with him 10 talents of silver, 6,000 shekels of gold, and 10 changes of clothing, which he brought. Then he brought the letter to the king of Israel. So he goes down through. Verse 8. So it was when Elisha the man of God heard that the king of Israel had torn his clothes, he sent to the king saying, Why have you torn your clothes? Let Naaman come to me, and he shall know that there's a prophet in Israel. So again, God has given the opportunity not only while he had worked through Naaman to bring Syria victory, as Elisha says, let him come here so he's going to know that there's a prophet in Israel. He's going to recognize that there's a difference. He's been leprous. He's a man of great stature and prominence. You think, I have the money, the money that can buy the best medical care possible. Well, he was in that position. His boss was the king. So he's next line down. If he had the opportunity to get it fixed, he would have done it. But he didn't have that opportunity until he hears about this. Then Naaman, verse 9, went with his horses and chariot, and he stood at the door of Elisha's house. Elisha sent a messenger to him, saying, Go and wash on the Jordan 7 times, and your flesh shall be restored to you, and you shall be clean. But Naaman became furious and went away and said, indeed, I said in myself, he will surely come out to me and stand and call on the name of the Lord. He's like, do you know who I am? I'm over all of the armies of Syria. You can at least come out. No, you send your servant out to tell me these things. So he's a little bit put off. He wanted there to be something fantastic. He says, wave his hand over the place and to heal the leprosy. But that's not how God decided to work with him. So he's a little bit angry about that. He says, couldn't I not wash in the rivers of Damascus? Aren't they better than all the waters of Israel? Could I not wash and be clean? And so he turned and went away in a rage. Verse 13, and his servants came near and spoke to him and said, my father, if the prophet had told you to do something great, would you not have done it? How much more then when he says to you, wash and be clean? So he went down, dipped 7 times in the Jordan according to the saying of the man of God, and his flesh was restored like the flesh of a little child, and he was clean. And he returned to the man of God, he and all his aides, and came and stood before him, and he said, indeed, now I know that there is no God in all the earth except in Israel. Now therefore, please take a gift from your servant. He acknowledged he had the means to get it taken care of from anywhere. But he goes there and he says, now I know that there is no God except in Israel. There's an acknowledgement, a recognition. He decided to attribute to God his healing. Just like Jethro, when he heard the stories, attributed to God the greatness and the power that he is and that he deserves. Let's go to Daniel chapter 4. Daniel chapter 4. Another individual, not of the nation of Israel. If you're seeing a trend here, it's because it's often difficult to find anybody not a prophet in the nation of Israel who actually acknowledged God as a supreme being in power, which is a sad testament to the nation of Israel. But it also should show us we are the spiritual nation of Israel. And where is our tendency? Is our tendency to acknowledge God and to give him the glory and the honor that he deserves? Do we, through what he does for us, acknowledge and get to know who he is and build that relationship with him? We're here in Daniel chapter 4, verse 34. This is King Nebuchadnezzar. And at the end of the 7 years, if you recall the story, he is walking along on his on the walls of his city. And he was a little bit haughty. And so he was looking around. And in contrast to what the prophet had told him, what Daniel had said, hey, this is going to happen to you if you don't change your attitude. Well, he changed his attitude for a little bit of time. But then he was walking out on the walls of his city. And he looks out and says, look at this great nation. Oh, I'm so amazing. And he's really pumping himself up. And the next thing you know, he loses his what makes him human. And he eats of the grass of the field, and he has a dew fall on him for 7 years. In verse 34, at the end of that time, that 7 years, I, Nebuchadnezzar, lifted my eyes to heaven, and my understanding returned to me. And I blessed the Most High, and praised and honored him who lives forever. For his dominion is an everlasting dominion, and his kingdom is from generation to generation. All the inhabitants of the earth are reputed as nothing. He does according to his will in the army of heaven, and among the inhabitants of the earth. No one can restrain his hand or say to him, what have you done? At the same time, my reason returned to me, and for the glory of my kingdom, my honor and splendor returned to me. My counselors and nobles resorted to me. I was restored to my kingdom, and excellent majesty was added to me. Now I, Nebuchadnezzar, praise and extol and honor the King of heaven, all of whose works are true, and his ways justice, and those who walk in pride he is able to put down. That's quite the turn. He saw that God followed through on his word. And he saw also that God restored him and brought him back. And he acknowledged God. He recognized God. Through the decisions that we make, the outcomes, the results of the decision we make, we get to see how God reacts with us, what he does. Well, Nebuchadnezzar decided to continue on with his pride and self-glorification. And so he had the negative outcome that God promised was going to come. But when that was done, he didn't just stay the way he was. He acknowledged God. He deferred to God. He recognized God as the King of heaven. He gave him honor and praise. Let's go to Romans chapter 1. Romans chapter 1. Like Jethro, like Naaman, like Nebuchadnezzar, we have the opportunity as we go about life, doing our things, the things that we have planned, making the 35,000 decisions a day that we do, we have the option of how we look at things and how we attribute things and to whom we attribute what happens. Here in Romans chapter 1, verse 16, it says, "For I am not ashamed of the gospel of Christ, for it is the power of God to salvation for everyone who believes, for the Jews first and also for the Greek. For in it the righteousness of God is revealed through the gospel of Jesus Christ." The righteousness of God is revealed from faith to faith, as it is written, "The just shall live by faith." For the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of man, who suppress the truth in unrighteousness. Because what may be known of God is manifest in them, for God has shown it to them. For since the creation of the world, his invisible attributes are clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made, even his eternal power and Godhead, so that they are without excuse. We have the opportunity to go through life, and we either attribute things to God, or we attribute things to ourselves. We either say, "Oh, look at this wonderful life that I have made for myself," as we're walking about around our house. "Look at all this greatness that I have, the wealth that I've accumulated. Look at how many friends I have. Look at all the opportunities that I've been able to make for myself." We can go that route. Nebuchadnezzar went that route, and he had a pretty hard awakening and a reminder. But we get to know God. We get to know that he keeps his word. We get to know him by looking out at his creation, by seeing the beauty and the wonder of the gospel of Jesus Christ and what that means for us and for all mankind. Let's go to John 14 here. John chapter 14. Start in verse 7. John 14, verse 7. We just read about God's attributes being made manifest through his creation. So we get to know him through what we see, what we experience, what we do in life. Here in John chapter 14, verse 7, it says, "If you had known me," this is Christ speaking, "you would have known my Father. From now on, you know him and have seen him." And Philip says to him, "Lord, show us the Father, and it is sufficient for us." Show me, so I can know. And Jesus said to him, "Have I been with you so long, and yet you have not known me, Philip? He who has seen me has seen the Father. So how can you say, 'Show us the Father'? Do you not believe that I am in the Father and the Father in me? And the words that I speak to you, I do not speak on my own authority, but the Father who dwells in me does the works. Believe me that I am in the Father and the Father in me, or else believe me for the sake of the works themselves." Through what God does in our lives, we get to see him. We get to know him. How he decides to interact with us in our life, how he decides to guide us, what he allows us to go through, we get to know him. How we decide to react to that is how he gets to know us. Of those 750 million decisions that we have over the course of life, we need to recognize that every single one of them is important. It has value. It has the opportunity to build towards that arc, to build towards the outcome where God looks at each of us and says, "Now I know." I don't know that there is a better compliment to have as a Christian than to have our Father say, "I know what you're going to do. I know you're going to follow me. I know that when you're put in this situation, there is no shadow of a doubt that you're going to react in this way. If Moses or if Abraham were to be put into a predicament where he has to decide on his life, what he's going to do, follow God or make an excuse because he thinks he can preserve himself, God's like, I know what you're going to do. You're going to follow me. His own child was on the line, the life of his own child, and he was willing to follow God. However small our individual decisions might seem, when you add them up, all of those decisions that we're making, the probabilities that go into making those, the reasons behind why we choose one way over the other, they're all extremely important. That's 750 million decisions that we have to make. But we have the opportunity through each and every one of those to let God know who we are, to let Him know that we want to be there in His family, to let Him know that we would like to be one of His children, and that we want to have that invitation. And that in the end, we want Him to say for each and every one of us, now I know.